My name is Caroline Knox, and I'm interviewing Dr. Rhett Mays, who is one of our internal medicine and also pediatric colleagues here in Asheville. And we're getting him fresh off of an almost 2-year period working as a general internal medicine consultant at the Christchurch Public Hospital in New Zealand. And I, for one, am hoping to gain some insight about what we can learn about the practice of medicine in a different country and a different healthcare system. So thank you for joining here today, Rhett.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
So we have talked a little bit about this just in passing, and we've kind of outlined this today. And one of the things that really comes up so frequently is that there is a major spending difference between these two countries. So I wondered if that would be something that you could talk a little bit about.
Yeah, of course. So for background, as you know, while we worked together, I was at Mission for 9 years as a hospitalist in pediatrics and internal medicine, splitting my time, and relocated in 2019 to New Zealand, taking a job as a consultant for general medicine, which is basically an internal medicine hospitalist with teaching responsibilities. And one of the things that was appealing to me about doing that as a sort of sabbatical is the fact that they have a public health system, a public health infrastructure that provides the majority of their medical care. And part of that is that they spend less than half of what we do per capita, adjusting for, back into American dollars, for better results. They have longer life expectancy and lower infant mortality, and so they're getting more for their money, and I'm interested to see how it is that they're accomplishing that.
Absolutely. And it sounds like you had that interest going into it. That was part of your reason for pursuing it. Was that proven to be true in your experience?
Well, it was tremendously informative. The thing that's always interesting is to see how that actually looks on a day-to-day basis. So where do you see that money is, that things are being done in a more streamlined fashion or more cost-effective fashion? I was lucky enough that neither myself nor my family had to use the healthcare system outside of primary care while we were there. So we were fortunate not to become patients in the system. But yeah, I mean, the expectations that I had about how it looks were pretty well borne out. I'd say that, if you've trained in the U.S., in the U.S. at, major medical centers that are catering and toward and often competing for clients that are coming sometimes from around the world, you're used to a certain level of what can almost be kind of opulence at U.S. hospitals. A private room is kind of the minimum expectation, and people often like to see, a lot of have a hotel feeling in their hospitals, or expect to see have kind of a hotel feeling, and that is not the way that hospitals in New Zealand are, nor is it what New Zealanders expect, nor is it what New Zealanders would accept, because they would be thinking of it in terms of money out of their own pocket, because everything is paid for through their tax dollars, which then go to the Ministry of Health and then are dispersed to these different regions, these regional district health boards. And so they have a very, and it's a small country, 5 million people. So people have a sense of ownership of the system. So they don't like to see money get wasted.
Just a follow-up question to that. Is there a difference in either what people want or what, the healthcare system wants of their patients in terms of length of stay in hospital?
Yeah. So, I mean, they track length of stay and other metrics that, that providers in the U.S. are provided feedback on if they're outside the margins. So their metrics are much the same, but I do think the expectations are a little different in that, for example, I would get, we would have monthly meetings, departmental meetings, and they would present team-based numbers about how many, about radiology usage and who was using the most of each type of imaging modality. And it was personalized. So, each team, which had an associated attending who was in a particular individual who everybody would immediately identify, was, everybody had shared, everybody could see everybody else's information, and that, and people were encouraged to, think about whether they were overutilizing or underutilizing certain resources. But MRI scans, for example, which we would get feedback on, are done far less frequently in New Zealand compared to the US. The statistic that I found was that per 1,000 population, there's something like 1,000, sorry, like 110 MRIs versus 4 for New Zealand. So
Wow.
that's a pretty spectacular difference.
Wow, a factor of 10
No,
or
20.
more.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so, and that there's a lot, there are many reasons for that, including the fact that MRIs are machines are not as available, but primarily that there's the entire structure from the top down is different, so there's no incentive to do studies for to prevent legal risk, because there is no individual provider risk in the in New Zealand. There's not a there's no such thing as being sued in a civil court for malpractice. Things are malpractice claims are adjudicated in by a government board, and there's no financial penalty. And also there's so defensive medicine is much less likely. And also there's much less demand for getting additional studies done from patients. So I think I might have told you the single most difficult encounter that I had while I was in New Zealand was with an American patient, because their expectations are different culturally. So,
And was that regarding tests and scans, or was that
yeah,
regarding?
it was the it was that particular encounter. The difficulty was that that person had purchased private insurance, which is available in New Zealand, and had seen a private provider and had a procedure done in private, not realizing that if complications arose from that, they would end up back in the public system and utilizing the resources available in the public system, because the private system there is quite small. There's no emergency services, there's no inpatient services to speak of. It's all mostly outpatient elective procedures or sort of 2-day obs elective procedures. And that's not what he thought he was paying for.
What you mentioned, fewer MRI scans per capita. Would you say that you witnessed any harms of doing fewer tests? You mentioned there were actually fewer scanners available. I don't know if that's the right
Oh, that's a
example,
good, yeah,
MRI.
that's a great question. I think I did witness, and hopefully not too frequently, probably participated in harm in the care of patients, just because if you interact with enough patients, you do make mistakes. I think you could, that under certain circumstances, that if our American tendency is to do too many things, I think you could, my perspective as an American is that their tendency is to do little. They tend to wait and see, and give things more time. Send a referral to a subspecialist, and there's a substantial, and there might be a wait before that encounter, and the problem may well have resolved by the time they're actually seen, or until a procedure is done. But in general, I would say my observation was much was that harms are more about problems within the system, that is to say, in navigating a complex system where you've got multiple providers who are all interacting with each other, and less about money spent or not spent on additional tests, and that the same
Gotcha.
risk that patients had in New Zealand were shared by us, despite the fact that we're paying a lot more.
I see.
No
And
doubt with
so
some exceptions.
And so there would be, so I guess what you're saying is, you know, here we may be chasing more incidentalomas because we have more scans, but probably in both systems we have the people who slip through the cracks or the people who have some iatrogenic error that, you know, it's just that our system has flaws. And so it's not that they're free of that because they do fewer, maybe superfluous tests, but they're not.
Yes, that's, I think they err toward errors of omission versus errors of commission, which is more of our, which is what we specialize in the US.
We're so fond of our specialist societies making recommendations, and I think, you know, our specialty societies, you know, we have a great deal of professionalism, which leads us in great directions. But I wondered if there's a different set of standards, like, you know, we have the USPSTF here. Are people leaning towards specialty societies for recommendations, or are they leaning towards the NHS guidelines, or what would be the guidelines that are sort of the gold standard
Yeah,
there?
so their guidelines are tend to be based on British Medical Society guidelines, so as opposed to US guidelines, which are less expert opinion based and more evidence based. So, you know, there's as an example, for example, patients who are in the hospital as inpatients are much less freak on the medical service as opposed to surgical services are much less routinely prophylaxed with Lovenox as inpatients because the evidence for prevention of preventive benefit of DVTs versus risk is a lot weaker in ambulatory adult patients. So they don't just routinely give everybody enoxaparin. And that's just one example that of many that where their guidelines would vary a little bit. Interestingly, though, their guidelines actually for treatment guidelines all the way down to the DHB level. So, for background, there are this country, which is geographically large but population small, is divided into 20 district health boards, which all separately get funding and determine how to use that funding to take care of their dependent population. And for certain things, they have to refer up to a district health board that has services that they don't provide, but otherwise they're expected to manage their population of patients. And the Canterbury District Health Board, which includes Christchurch, and which is the biggest district health board in the South Island, has accessible to all of their providers their own guidelines, which their own providers are responsible for maintaining, which are specific to them and the resources that they have available locally. So, for example, there was only one dermatologist working for the public system in that district health board. And so, what the spectrum of care and the amount that was expected of general practitioners and other providers in terms of managing dermatologic problems based on the guidelines prior to referral was broader than it would have been in a district in a DHB that had a dozen dermatologists.
Gotcha.
Should such a district health board exist? I don't know that they're, I don't know, perhaps Auckland or Wellington, but I thought that was quite interesting because it seemed both labor intensive and also sort of unacceptably risky if you were in the US. I mean, the idea that a single hospital or hospital system would have totally independent, comprehensive guidelines for care, which could very easily become out of date or out of sync with national practice or national standards. Once you have it, you have to maintain it, and it's a lot of work. But they do it, and I think part of the reason why they're able to do that is because they have less legal exposure, and also I think because they and less external scrutiny, and also because it's effective because it's targeted toward the resources that they actually have and not the resources that they could have.
Interesting. So specialty level dermatology, would be much more commonly handled by a primary care doctor in the Canterbury DHB as opposed to another DHB or another part of the country.
Yeah, just based on availability of those services, and that has to do with that relative availability of dermatology is an example of one of the things that where they don't exist in isolation from the other health systems around, and other places essentially are poaching their dermatologists all the time by paying them more money,
Interesting.
which is part of the problem of maintaining a public health system, is you've got to have people who are willing to work according to the rates negotiated by the union. So when I was there, I was a member of the consultants union, which represents all consultants who work in the public health system in New Zealand, and that they negotiate on a I think biannual basis. I can't remember the terminal the frequency, but they're constantly in renegotiation for different terms, and all consultants essentially work under the same basic employment terms. So you can imagine here that might be unpopular if you had a subspecialist who was had trained in a field and that where they expected to make considerably more, having to make and where they could make considerably more in other countries like Australia. Having to draw the same salary as everybody else.
Would you say there was any incentive in working in the public health system there?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I mean, I personally enjoyed it. If I had something similar available to me in the US, I would jump at the chance to work for it. And a lot of those are exactly the inverse of what providers in the US negotiates for. So for example, for me, for prior employers, I've worked where the rate at which you're paid is pretty good, but the benefits associated are pretty thin, such that as long as you're working and productive, you have a good income, but your risk should you become sick or family member become sick or untoward events happen that prevent you from working full time, your exposure is large, whereas there, your exposure is very low. And you have, built-in benefits like paid time off and sick leave, et cetera, that protect people, more. So people who work in the public health system to my eye, have a good deal
Gotcha.
overall. Although their likelihood of becoming wealthy from the practice of medicine is zero.
So people are there, what would you say the ratio is of people who are from New Zealand that choose to practice in the public system to foreign medical grads or people who came from elsewhere like you?
Oh yeah, it depends highly on where you are. So New Zealanders, just like physicians in the US and anywhere else, predominantly grow up and if not grow up, train in larger areas, larger towns. Their spouses get jobs in larger towns. So competition for jobs in the metro areas is tight. So Christchurch, Wellington, Auckland suburbs. Outside of those three areas, the country is predominantly rural, and rural in the way that only large Western states are rural, with vast empty spaces in between small communities. So big cities are have a lot more native Kiwi physicians. The rural areas have difficulty recruiting New Zealanders
Yes.
who, if they can't get a position in a large center in New Zealand, often are attracted to go work in Australia, at least in the early years of their careers, because they can make more money in Australia through the system that they have there. Australia has a sort of more blended public-private system that is much more productivity based, and people who do work there can make more money. So it's not uncommon for people to spend 10 years of their career, and certainly some of their training time in Australia along the way. My own department in general medicine had lots of people who had trained in other countries, and that just has to do with, I think, much like in the US, doing general practice isn't the most popular thing to do because of the amount of work sort of that's given to you by other providers in the system that the that j they're just like here subspecialists tend to try to spend most of their time doing whatever procedural thing they can't they are skilled to do and procedural tasks, patient interactions, medication reconciliation, discussions with family, social issues, the things that you and I have spent our careers doing, those come to general medicine. And just like in the US, it's an unpopular way to spend your time. So there were a large number of people who trained in the UK as well, who were in my department, who preferred working in New Zealand to working for the National Health Service,
Interesting.
or more commonly preferred to live in New Zealand to preferring in the UK. Yeah. So in rural areas, you can, and you would know this better than I, having spent your year there, your the prevalence of physicians trained elsewhere is really high.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, and there's a lot of turnover in those rural areas
Yeah, and I think that's
as well.
I think part of the reason that that's different is because, like we talked about previously, the only providers in the New Zealand system that are not employees of the AHB, essentially employees of the government, are general practitioners or the primary care physicians who are private but who bill the public system essentially as a single payer system. So they those GP clinics are run like businesses, and they're run in places where it's hard to find labor, and so they tend to go to sources of less expensive labor. And there are plenty of Americans who wouldn't mind taking a salary cut to get to spend some time living and working in New Zealand, and they benefit from that. In the same way that small communities like the one I grew up in benefit from physicians trained outside the US who are seeking a US visa. Are willing to move to a rural area to come there. So, and thank goodness they do, because otherwise these small towns wouldn't have doctors.
This is an interesting part of the New Zealand health system. Could you talk a little bit about the ACC?
Yeah, so I'm afraid I don't know much about the historic origins of ACC, but ACC is an insurance system that is provided through the government, but is a separate fund from the public fund that pays for healthcare, pays for the care of anyone who is hurt in an accident of any type, no matter how boneheaded the origin of the injury. So if you crash your motorcycle or if you fall off a roof while you're at work, ACC comes in and pays both the public system to take care of you, as in a similar way that Medicare might pay the VA to in the US, and they also pay for all kinds of things outside the public system to get you back rehabilitated and back to work. And I think that the origin was that early on, jobs in New Zealand were rural and disability injuries were really common, and then you ended up with this large population of disabled people who couldn't return to work because of this lingering effects of these injuries from from farming.
That was
So
definitely
yeah, so
part
and
of
the
my
ACC
time.
system is really it's really great in that it provides benefits far outside of what we would have in the US. So your surgery for your femoral fracture would be covered, but also but so would but you get your salary paid for some defined period of time while you recover, which is based on some indexed value, and you have physical therapy that can come to your home that's paid for, or even cleaning services that will come to your home if you can't manage to buy groceries or do your vacuuming. They will provide somebody who does that. And even with all of those costs, the cost of all that coverage, which as you imagine can be abused, just like some less robust systems in the US are, they that even including all of that, they're still spending way less money than we are. Just to, kind of on the same line, I just there's way more effort keeping elderly frail patients at home rather than in skilled nursing facilities there because it's less expensive. And so in general, home services, home physical therapy, home cleaning assistance, home safety evaluations, transportation assistance, that system is much more robust because the government knows that if they're paying for facilities, facility costs are much higher than keeping people in their own home.
So are people living longer with better functional status, or are we just allowing people to, or what would be the difference there? You know, if you could imagine an American patient who's, you know, elderly with limited functional status, maybe some dementia, what would that, how would that person do in both health systems? Could you give an example of somebody like that if you've dealt with someone like that?
So, you know, someone who is someone as somebody in New Zealand is more likely to live in their own home longer. They're more likely to get benefits that keep them at home longer. They're also likely to live further from family. So, because New Zealand is a country populated by recent immigrants, lots of people's family live a long way away. Their children may live in Australia, they may live in the UK, they may live in the Netherlands or Americans, and so there are a lot of people who don't have a lot of close family network to assist them. I don't know that my exposure in Christchurch is maybe the most typical, just because Christchurch is much more Caucasian than the New Zealand average. It's much more urban than the New Zealand average, so I think it probably isn't a good kind of average reflection, but my observation of the New Zealand population was that elderly people tended to be much more robust there, and to stay at home longer and to be much more active and socially engaged. There's a lot of like in the UK, there's a lot of social clubs that exist and that cater toward people who are elderly and who are frail, that gets people out of the house and moving. And the culture there is much more about being outside and fitness, and
Yes.
you know, there's a
Even my frail elderly people, I remember, would go do what's that? They all they go lawn bowling.
Oh yeah,
That
bowls,
was
absolutely. Yeah, so we're in Asheville on Sunday afternoons. The patients come in from the I think it's the S&W cafeteria where there's a syncope or heart attack. There it's from the bowling it's from the bowling greens where they lawn bowl.
How about in the hospital? Can you talk about such a patient and how they might get different hospital
Oh yeah,
care, an
absolutely.
elderly
So
person?
inpatients, quite interesting. So most of the hospital wards are 6-bed wards, the way that they would have been in the US in the 60s. And you can imagine that there are, you know, discomforts associated with that. There are no televisions. There in Christchurch is no air conditioning, which fortunately is not a very hot city. And patients are encouraged to wear their own clothes while they're in the hospital, to get dressed, to put their jammies on at night and get comfortable, but to change back into the clothes that they're comfortable in and put their shoes and socks on, and bathrooms are physically located outside the room and are shared, and so you have to be they're encouraged to ambulate to the bathroom. So where
So
we
hence no
often
Lovenox.
yeah hence no Lovenox, and also you get a much Whereas in the US, where I'm often seeing a patient and deciding whether they can go home, and the next question is, well, can this person actually even get out of bed because they've been in bed for the last 3 or 4 days? Or ambulating, the 3 feet that it takes to get to their private bathroom. You know that well in advance for patients in New Zealand because you pass them on their way to the bathroom when you were seeing the prior patient. And they, if they can do for themselves in the hospital, then generally they can do for themselves at home.
Gosh, I wonder if we could do that here. I guess it would require
Yeah.
a lot more staff to make sure that people had the assistance they needed.
Yeah, I think that's probably the big difference. There was a lot more nursing aid assistance and a lot more much lower staffing ratios for nurses. So there were just a lot more hands around to chaperone people to and from places to keep them from being falls. Falls are still a problem, just like you'd imagine they are anywhere in the hospital, and they take them quite seriously when they happen. But
But there's a good amount of staff to hopefully prevent a lot of
there's
those.
a huge amount of staff. Yeah, absolutely.
That's great.
So I really did consider that a pretty substantial advantage over the way that we do things in the US, although other people might look at it and say, well, if you were one of these 6 patients in the hospital ward, you wouldn't feel that way because you have a hard time sleeping with someone who's delirious 3 beds down.
What,
So.
so you were there during the start of the pandemic, and I wondered if you had any elderly patients that ended up on a mechanical ventilator getting intubated for breathing assistance
Yeah,
due to
no, I
that.
no, certainly not. So, context there, I think I'd been there about 9 months when COVID came and or was coming. And of course the country had the geographic advantage of just being able to stop flights coming in, and but they also implemented a very stringent lockdown early on. They gave about 48 hours notice that everybody was going to be confined to their house, plus with the ability to go to the grocery store, pharmacies, and the hospital, and otherwise were expected to stay home. Nobody who didn't work at one of those 3 locations was to be out except, for exercise, and which most people seem to be all day long. And that lasted about 6 weeks, and then it was stepped down and lasted another 2 weeks, and then on until life was back to normal. No one knew how much COVID was already in New Zealand when the outbreak started, but the presumption was that there would be a considerable amount because there's a huge amount of international travel. But in Christchurch itself, there were really only a few younger people who'd recently traveled, who had returned to their immediate household members who were affected, and a couple of facilities that had elder frail populations. So one of which was, my recollection was sort of a what you would think of as a skilled nursing facility here, which is almost more like an old-fashioned, like a rooming house. It's they people are provided to sort of people mostly take care of themselves. You can have no more than, if you need help getting up and getting dressed, they'll provide that, but beyond and providing your medications, but otherwise not much. So one in there, and there were a few cases there, and then another facility which had several levels of care but included a dementia unit that was for people who are very frail, so 2-person assist or more. And a large there was a very large cluster of patients there who got exposed to COVID, and that in that setting the Public Health Service, which is its own wing of the health system, came into the facility, found that it was going to be too hard to isolate patients from one another and to keep staff safe, and so elective surgeries had been stopped. At the public hospital, they moved, instead of hospitalizing all those patients immediately, they moved them all to the to the rehab hospital, which was the other
Oh.
part of the public system, but was empty because there were no elective surgeries going on, and those patients were all managed there. And in New
And what,
Zealand, the
yeah, what
first
level
patients,
of
yeah, so they
medical
could pro
care did they
so
need?
it was a hospital facility, but their goals of care for that particular population was universally palliative. So those patients were all treated as though they had pre-existing do not resuscitate orders and were managed effectively palliatively. To my knowledge, none of those residents were ever hospitalized in the public hospital, in the primary public hospital, and certainly didn't reach the ICU. I think 12 died in a cluster that
So no high flow
about 26
oxygen,
patients, and that
no
represented
bypass.
almost half of the total deaths of COVID so far.
Wow.
So 12 of 26 patients total in the country were out of one facility, which just goes to show you the lethality of COVID among the elderly frail population when it gets there, but also it shows you a difference in management. And there wouldn't have been a public hospital to empty those, an empty public hospital to empty those people into. There isn't a
Right.
public health service to come in and make decisions and discuss with families. It's unlikely that you'd have 20 plus families who are all willing w to utilize primarily a palliative approach for patients. Supportive measures, IV fluids, medications, and oxygen, but no ICU kind of
No positive
interventions.
pressure ventilation or anything like
Yeah,
that.
it's unlikely that you would encounter a scenario in the U.S. where you'd have all of those families being happy to have their loved one managed in that way. But as a result, myself, as a physician who was on the COVID service in the hospital, and thousands of other people who were in and out of the hospital were never exposed to COVID
Wow.
in that sort of kind of uncontrolled early days time. And it was particularly important there because just like their hospital's beds being six bed wards, their ICU capacity on a per capita basis is much smaller. And as is their availability of reverse isolation rooms, so their system could have very easily been overrun,
Wow.
and wasn't because of some very careful decisions and some very, thoughtful decision making by families to be agreeable to that level of care.
Is that like a national ethos of taking care of oneself and one's own family, or is that a public that really trusts public health recommendations, or how do you account for that difference?
I think it's several things. One is that the legalities are different. So in New Zealand, the decision for code status discussion and for escalation of care is the physicians and not the family. So where here, we're often we know what the outcome is likely to be. We're still dependent on families to make the decision that we based on the information that we provide to them, and often that decision is counter to the best interest of the patient. And counter to our recommendations, and there that's much less likely to happen because the authority is with the medical provider.
Interesting. And
Although
is
I
that due
didn't
to
see a lot of,
trust?
I think it has to do with knowledge. I think part of it is that the idea in the U.S. that you can offer that you can inform someone adequately to make a decision in a brief conversation is absurd, because the only people who are really informed in that encounter are the people who've had the experience of seeing multiple patients go through the same situation and have an internalized sense for how this is how what's likely to happen, and they
Wow.
recognizing that just assume that it's the provider that's the person who's most likely to make a well-informed decision. But also I think there's less distrust of the system generally. I think much more than that, the biggest part is that New Zealanders in general tend to have the attitude that they, well, like the expression that people would would use all the time is, I've had a good run. They would say,
Mm-hmm.
if I don't get better from this, well, that's okay. There's not much clinging to
The
life
promise
at
of
the end of
longevity,
somebody.
or
Like, and much more interest, much less interest in living a long life, if living a long life means living under the dependency of others.
Would you
So
say there's also more personal ownership of the consequences of lifestyle choices?
that might be true. Yeah, that might be true. I think it probably depends on the individual level, but yeah.
And
Yeah,
then
I think.
it sounds like you were seeing more acute care for hospitalized patients, but would you think that preventive care is more valued than sort of costly reactive care as disease progresses?
It seems to be, although again, I wasn't on that on the preventive medicine side, so I'm less informed about that. There's a lot more, as a practitioner in the New Zealand system, there's a lot more visibility of what you're doing and how it impacts patients. So,
So sort of
for
accountability.
yeah, well. And just a transparency. The biggest one of my major complaints of working in the US system is that we are constantly making recommendations for treatment, recommendations for particular medications or diagnostic testing, with no knowledge of how that, what the financial impact of that testing will be, what the financial impact of that prescription over the next 6 weeks or 6 months or 6 years is going to be. And there, that the services that you're providing when you're inpatient are, there's no direct cost to them. So you can just make a decision, is it of use or is it not of use to them? Without having to worry about about direct cost burden once they've arrived. And then medications not in the hospital are, there's no direct cost, but also when you discharge patients, there's a copay for medications and there's a national formulary. So I can go online,
Wow.
I can look to see if a medication is available, I can know exactly what the copay is ahead of time and inform the person of what the copay is, which is standardized amongst all medications. There's not a tier system. And sometimes that means telling them that the medicine that I would use in this scenario isn't available. Almost always, though, there's a it's if there is a PPI, for example, that they had been on previously, and the New Zealand government may have negotiated for a better price for a different one, and they have to switch from one drug of a class to another drug of a class, and it makes no difference. And exactly what that cost could be, whereas, as in the US, you might not even change drugs, you might simply change delivery method for an inhaler, or go from a oral solution to a tablet, or a standard release formulation to an extended release formulation, and the cost goes up by a factor of 10, and you have no way of knowing, unless you get feedback from the patient to say, "I'm sorry, I can't afford this. Is there something else you can prescribe?"
How did you feel as a provider? Did that give you, were you able to treat people in like you said, the evidence-based way that you would hope to do that?
I mean, I think that there's much less likelihood that you're going to send somebody home with a prescription that they simply won't be able to afford to take. There are some limitations. For example, some waiting lists for care are longer than you would want them to be for things that follow up. So sometimes you found yourself doing things as an inpatient that you would otherwise refer as an outpatient study because they have a limitation on, they have a backlog in terms of getting, say, a colonoscopy or an EGD done, or a general surgical procedure. For the most part, those shortages are driven not by lack of availability of providers in the country, but by a conflict that's come up between small private system and the public system that where certain subspecialists are able to maintain a position in the public system, but are often double dipping into a private system that allows them to be advantaged if the wait list gets a little longer, then more patients tend to pop off into their private clinic, and then they're reimbursed at a better rate for patients that are seen there. I don't think that's a common, I don't think anybody's making that decision consciously, but it is certainly an effect of people being available, taking a position in the public health system, but not always being available to do their work in an efficient fashion, partially because they're in their private clinic.
I see.
So
So
there.
is that one of your most favorite things about the New Zealand system, the formulary?
Oh yeah, I love the formulary. I mean,
What else would you tr yeah, what would you
from a day to
transplant?
day system, that's a big one, I think. But I think the bigger part of it is just that there is a system. I think people refer, you know, people outside, people who don't work in healthcare like you and I do, refer to the U.S. healthcare system all the time. It's referred to in media postings all the time. And of course, there is no healthcare system in the U.S. There is no uniformity to it at all. U.S. healthcare is a collection of consumers and a collection of payers. And a collection of providers who all have different interests, often counter to one another. And there's a tremendous amount of waste in just administratively in managing that system. And most people, I think, in the US who are practicing in medicine would like to see that go away. Would like to see a uniform system that, even if, like New Zealand's or the UK system or the Canadian system, is far from perfect, it at least provides basic services and is very unlikely to bankrupt you when you.
I'm just looking at the statistic you sent me. So their life expectancy is 81.9, ours is 78.6, I think.
That's
And
correct.
they spend 9.3% of their GDP
Yeah,
per
compared to about
versus
17%.
16, 17 of what we're
Yeah.
is what we're spending.
Yeah,
And
so
then the
we
what that looks
spend.
like in dollars per capita.
Yeah, so and of course the GDP number is a little misleading. It's a little worse than that because their GDP is much their pr productivity per person is lower than ours is. So it's they're spending way less than we are. I think in the US we have to decide what our goals are. Is the goal for the healthcare system to be a part of a, you know, the 20% of a ever expanding economic system that pumps money, that moves money around, or are we going to decide that healthcare is something that we want to make available to people and free everyone from the anxiety of worrying about when something unexpected and devastating occurs. You know,
Absolutely.
the there of course is no nothing like employer-based healthcare systems, so people there, you know, can transition between jobs or go out and start a new business or you know, stop working and spend 6 months doing something different without fear of catastrophe.
Losing that benefit, right.
Yeah. So it's a superior system, there's no question. I think the only question to me is, you know, is are Americans going to be willing to, are we both willing and able to look outside at systems, you know, outside the US for direction about how to do things better? I think that a cultural flaw that we have is that we tend to assume that whatever, however we're doing something is the better way. I'm glad we're confident. But that's in this case, it's clearly not true. And there's no shortage of other countries that we can look to that do it better. You could essentially look anywhere. You know, the some of the statistics that I've pulled forward and sent through to you are from this Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, which is a collection of 37 countries around the world that include countries that you would assume are offering services on par to the US, like Germany or the UK, Japan.
Right.
But others of them are like Hungary and Estonia, and they're all doing better than we are.
Wow.
It's just a question of whether we have a will to implement something better.
Yeah, that humility is such a huge part. And I think that was one thing that impressed me so much over there was listening to more of an, just international guidelines as opposed to just our country's specialty society, which, we clearly have financial incentives as different specialty societies to incentivize more costly things and procedures and tests, than if you look at it strictly from a mortality or really evidence-based perspective.
Yeah, I think, mentioning humility, one of the things that's distinctive there from here is that when you interact with patients, they expect to call you by your first name. You are expected to call them by their first name, even if they're, an 85-year-old. The basic patient interaction is a little is different. The expectation that they are there as a they're it's not a, exactly a consumer relationship the way that it is in the US. It's not ex and it's not a authority figure versus patient relationship. It's much more egalitarian than that. And I think if the you if we as physicians can learn to take that on, it will help us. It would help us tremendously to get off our high horse and
Right,
to.
and also offload some of the weight that we
Yeah,
feel like we
sure.
carry.
That we carry around, right? Because of course we don't have all the answers, and it's folly to pretend like we do.
Right. Well, thank you so much for sharing this. I wanted to catch you before you were too far away in your memory before you
Yeah, no, it's good to have gone over it again because it's amazing how quickly time passes and then your thoughts on it.
Well, good. Well,
We
thank you
can,
so
you know,
much, Rhett.
I've had a chance to get everything down. This is very helpful. Yeah, and for anybody who might be listening, of course, you yourself have worked in New Zealand. There are several other providers in the Asheville area who have, and if people are considering doing something different for, mid-career sabbatical, there's plenty of local knowledge about how you might do that. Encourage it.
Absolutely. I'm always encouraging people to take the leap if they can do it personally.
Yeah.
So,
All right. Thanks so much.
all right. Well, thank you.